It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. United Way of Southwestern Pennsylvania raised more than $37 million in 2018 at a time when individual giving declined nationwide. So as new leadership steps in, what's next for the local chapter? Bobby Watgear took over as CEO and president of the local United Way on Monday. Bobby, congratulations. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I'm happy to be here.
You joined the United Way officially, I guess, in 2007, but volunteered before then. What is the organization for you, and who do you feel that you serve?
The United Way is an organization with a very long history of serving people in need in local communities. In fact, United Way is over 130 years old nationally. Locally, we've been at work in our communities in southwestern PA for almost 100 years. Mm-hmm. And we bring together corporate partners, community partners, and human service agencies to help people who are in need, whether that be financially struggling families, children, seniors, or people with disabilities.
Not long after you started at United Way, the Great Recession hit. United Way sustained a bit of a dip in contributions at that time. What were you thinking then? Not a good time for fundraising, or the needs even greater than it had been?
Absolutely. When we enter recessionary periods, that's when people in the community need the most support. And so we had to be more creative and more assertive in raising those dollars to support people who needed that help.
You served most recently as Senior Vice President of Administration. How has that experience prepared you for the new role as CEO?
What I really enjoyed about that experience was that it gave me the inside-out view of the organization. So I had the opportunity to work in the Westmoreland region prior to coming into Pittsburgh, and being the Senior Vice President of Administration gave me the organization-wide perspective of the organization from the inside out. So I think it really helped me in terms of preparing for this position.
And you always have to look outward because it's the community that you're serving?
Absolutely. And that's one of my key first priorities, is spending time meeting with our corporate and community partners, listening to what their ideas and concerns are about how we can better fulfill our mission.
Did longtime former CEO Bob Nelkin, now retired, offer any parting wisdom to you?
Bob's offered me a lot of wisdom over the several years that we've worked together, but I think from Bob's perspective, parting words would have been, we have to keep innovating. We have to keep innovating and looking for critical partnerships to advance our work.
The United Way nationally and regionally focuses on several different charitable causes, children and youth, financially struggling families, people with different abilities, seniors and others. Are any of these pillars you feel more pressing than others, at least right now?
All four of those focus areas that we invest our dollars in are the building blocks to a better life. And so it's difficult to say that in any given time, one is more urgent than the other. However, I will say that when families are struggling financially, hardworking families, and they don't have the basic needs of shelter and food and the ability to pay their utilities, that is a deep concern to be able to live a full and healthy life.
Do they tend to be traditional areas that you want to focus on, or do even those areas of need evolve?
The areas of need over time, and that's really the beauty of United Way, is that we're always looking at what are the most critical needs in our community, and how do we invest to solve those problems and prevent them going forward. So there may at times be needs that are more urgent than others, but together, those areas are really the bedrock of what United Way focuses on in our community.
Whether it's advocacy or volunteerism, what's going to be your approach? What are your plans to get more people involved to address some of those critical community needs? Yeah.
That's the core. United Way builds on partnerships. We have to engage people in our mission. And if you don't understand what the community issues and problems are, you're not going to be compelled to help solve them by contributing or volunteering. So one of the first and really important steps is, how can we engage people as volunteers? going out into the community, understanding what the needs are, helping to address them. That's a gateway into understanding and wanting to help more to solve the problems.
So what are you, a facilitator, a convener, or what?
We are a convener. We are a problem solver in the community. So I think those are really the hallmarks of who we are, that we are in a very unique position to bring together corporate leaders, community partners, public leaders as well, to focus on what are the human service needs and how do we build better lives for everyone in southwestern PA.
Short term, what connections do you really want to work on now?
So over the next 90 days, I will be out in the community. I think on day three, I already have 30 meetings scheduled to be out talking with corporate and community leaders and partners throughout our region. We do cover a 4.5 county area in southwestern PA, and really listening and understanding what the needs are in the community so that we can better address them. In the long term, we obviously want to be focusing on those four key areas of children, people with disabilities, seniors, and financially struggling families, and creating a more equitable and accessible community for everyone.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're here with the new president and CEO of the United Way of Southwestern Pennsylvania, Bobby Watgear. According to the annual study by Giving USA, released just really a couple of weeks ago, charitable donations by individuals dropped by $3 billion nationwide last year. How has that national shift in giving affected your arm in the United Way?
Last year, we actually saw a little bit of an increase in our total campaign here in southwestern PA. So we were fortunate. We work very hard to continue to engage local donors. So we didn't see a downturn this past year, but it's something that we continually keep an eye on and are working to make sure that we have the resources needed to address problems.
So that 1%, was that due to maybe more corporate and foundation, or was the did the individual donations keep up as opposed to the nationwide trend last year?
United Way is an organization that really relies on individual donations. We have over 50,000 donors to United Way. So we have been managing to engage next generation donors and continuing to engage corporate donors as well as foundation contributions as well.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to have to rely, as the years go by, are you going to have to rely more on corporations and foundations, do you think?
The trend that we're seeing, and Giving USA reports this as well, is that donors who contribute larger amounts of money are making the larger share of gifts. And so United Way has pivoted some of its focus to attract and retain and grow larger donors as we see smaller donors drop off as a proportion of total giving.
The $3 billion, many analysts attribute all this to the new tax laws, or at least a chunk of it. If fewer people are donating because it's not worth it for them in terms of tax deductions, how do you appeal to maybe the middle income earners who are just taking the standard deduction and not worried about, oh, I ought to give this charity so I can deduct it on my taxes?
First of all, I'd like to say that I think it's a little bit premature to attribute the drop in giving to changes in tax laws. I think we need to see a little bit more data before we mm-hmm. can make that conclusion. And while that is certainly perhaps one motivation to give, I think that if we continue to attract donors and help them understand what the needs are in the community, that the tax incentives will not necessarily be the driving force.
How do you respond to people who might say, I'll just contribute directly to the individual charities that I favor?
Yeah. So United Way has the incredible ability to be able to bring together in partnerships agencies who address the problems together. So most of the issues that we're working on are complex human service problems, and they're not solved by one agency. And so United Way is working at a 30,000 foot level to understand those problems and issues, and then bringing together the agencies who can best address them, and they work in partnership to do that. And so there's the convening power and the ability to address problems from multiple perspectives in partnership. So it's not about a single agency addressing completely one problem in the community.
Do you think you can leverage more and partner various agencies, various charities that do similar work?
Absolutely. And the other piece of it is that we monitor the outcomes, that we, as we go through the process of awarding the grants in the community, that there are specific outcomes that we're that the agencies are agreeing to achieve, and that we monitor those, and that we can report back to the community the achievements that and the progress that we've made on solving that problem.
How do you balance that with maybe fewer dollars go directly to the organizations because of you have to serve as that convener?
I would argue that more dollars go to those organizations because we're able to bring in 50,000 plus contributors to the community, and that we are able to leverage the partnerships that we have with corporations and other community partners to engage them and to elevate what are these problems and issues that need to be solved in our community.
In our last minute, your future plans. What are your long-term plans? We heard about your 90-day plan.
Sure.
What are your long-term plans for the United Way?
Well, as I briefly mentioned, United Way is a regional organization. We have a 4.5 county service area, and that we want to be able to grow our ability to best meet the needs throughout our region. We're still very young in that process and want to be able to grow that level of effectiveness and build our programs and our engagement of donors and volunteers across the region.
And is that personal contact? What is that?
That's a lot of work with partnerships. It's being out in the community. It is engaging more donors, more leaders through our local boards and our regional board as well.
Bobby Watgear is the new CEO of the United Way of Southwestern Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me today.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, we'll meet a comedian who teaches people with Down syndrome improv and stand-up comedy techniques that lend themselves to job skills. And what should you do with an old tattered American flag? We'll find out how to retire your old glory with respect. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, iconic chemist Marie Curie dies in 1934. Born in Poland, Curie conducted pioneering research on radioactivity and was the first woman to win the Nobel Prize and the first to win it twice. Curie visited Pittsburgh on her first trip to the United States in 1921, stopping at the radium refining plant. Curie had discovered radium, which is used in luminescent paint and some medical tests. At the time, the plant was where most of the radium of the country was extracted. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Athletes are getting ready for the Summer Olympics in Tokyo next year, but in Philadelphia, there's a group of rowers with a much longer-term goal. The city is hosting one of six Olympic development camps already preparing for the 2028 Summer Games in Los Angeles. WHYY's Mark Eichmann spent some time with the team on the Schuylkill River.
On a recent Wednesday morning, the group of 30 young women is just starting a morning session of rowing on the Schuylkill River. John Cohn directs them on the exact placement of their hands as they pull their oars and glide through the water.
All right, let's make sure we're setting our feet. At the release, your thumbs should rub against your ribs, but be able to pass through.
Over the past 2 weeks, Cohn has led these young women, ages 14 to 17, in the regional camp for U.S. rowing. He says at the last Summer Games in Rio, U.S. rowing won just 2 medals in 14 events. This group has a strong showing at the 2028 Olympics in L.A. in mind.
So this is the age group. This is the current group that will most likely be competing. And so we really wanted to step up our game and make sure that we show well at our home games.
We're going for maximum speed with minimal effort.
The group is made up of rowers from Virginia to New Jersey and trains out of the Temple University Boathouse on the Schuylkill River. They row twice a day in addition to on-land workouts and classroom lessons.
Rowing on the Schuylkill is an iconic rowing experience. And of course, being around Boathouse Row is inspiring. There are other hopeful national team athletes on the river all the time. It's a strong place to be.
I've learned a lot here. I have come here and almost kind of starting over, learning a bunch of new technique, but I think it's really helped.
Charlotte Hall is a rising junior from Chesapeake, Virginia.
I've thought about Olympics and everything, and it's been an idea of mine that I'd like to pursue. But as of right now, I'm focusing on making it to college rowing, and then after that, I think I'll decide then.
And though it's not clear whether Hall or any of the other women will make the 2028 Olympic team, Cohn is trying to build a foundation of good form and good habits that can help give these women a better shot.
So we talked to them about nutrition and recovery and rest and all of the little things that elite athletes do that ultimately make the difference between, you know, making an Olympic team or not, or getting gold or silver.
It's a different approach than he would typically take in his regular job training high school rowers in Delaware.
We're not really trying to get the athletes to be exceptionally fast right now. So we have to have a major focus on the athletes' long-term development. So it's really difficult to get teenagers to think 9-10 years ahead. So for now, the goals that we talk about are about what they need to do to possibly make the under-19 national team over the next year or two. That's a lot more tangible for them.
Celeste, there you go. Celeste Funari-Muse, a rising junior from Bryn Mawr, says she's impressed by her teammates' dedication, even though the LA Games are so far away, and there's no guarantees that any of them will qualify.
Every single girl here is so passionate about this sport. They're willing to put themselves through so much pain to see the results that they want, and seeing that much passion from so many people my age is really inspiring.
All right, let's spin, head across, and head home.
This is the team's final week of training on the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia. Next week, the team will meet with rowers from five other regions in Sarasota, Florida, for combined training. The regions will also race each other for bragging rights. Mark Eichmann in Wilmington.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Can comedy put people to work? People with disabilities face an unemployment rate twice as high as their peers. Rob Snow teaches improv and stand-up comedy to people with disabilities in order to develop job skills. He runs Stand Up for Downs and coaches the Improvineers. Snow and comedy student Danny Chase spoke with reporter Marissa Niwa, who has Down syndrome.
How did the Improvineers get their start?
So we started just teaching improvisation monthly at a Gigi's Playhouse in Cleveland. And then we had such great results and some improved skills by the people taking the classes that I said, what if we took this and auditioned a cast, taught it weekly? And so that's how the Improvineers were born.
How did your son Henry do with Down syndrome?
Well, so that's what brought me to it. My son Henry, obviously, he's the catalyst for why I do this. And, you know, we started Stand Up for Downs because of him, which is the way a lot of charities start or nonprofits start, because we want what's best for our children. And I looked at Henry and I said, what can we do to create a better world for Henry? So originally when we started creating Stand Up for Downs, we just raised a ton of money and we saw all these great organizations. And we just started giving them as much money as we could and as much money as we could raise so that those organizations would be better, create a better life for my son, and in effect, for everybody who has Down syndrome. So he's been my reason, but now it's really everybody that I've come to know and love in the Down syndrome community. He's a great improviser and a very funny young man himself.
Nice.
Yeah, you'd love him.
What is your favorite part of this experience?
Seeing the fruits of the labor, so getting to see the results of what we're doing and how effective it is, and seeing that improv can be kind of this missing link to creating more and more jobs for those with special needs, and that I've kind of gained a second family out of it. 9 performers that I have grown to love, and I think they've grown to love me. So that's probably my favorite part.
How can comedy help with people with Down syndrome find work?
Well, I think comedy and what we're doing with improvisation teaches so many new skills that other job and other schooling doesn't really teach. It teaches things like voice projection and eye contact. It teaches problem solving and quick thinking, teamwork and focus and leading a team and things like that, and creativity. And it teaches people humor, and it gives them a lot of self-confidence. Those are all amazing skills that help people get new and bigger and better jobs. So your job opportunities start to expand and expand and expand from what they were before.
I'm Danny. I work at Sierra Point in Ohio, being one of the characters there, Peanuts characters, Newbie and Linus.
So yeah, she's got a great case study too. So she started working at Cedar Point in the last year, right?
Yeah.
And you were able to tell them that you did improv and everything. Mm-hmm. And so she's a character, which is really cool because, you know, in improv you're talking on stage, but at Cedar Point, she's a character. So she's in the suit and everything like that. So she's not able to talk, so you better be pretty expressive otherwise. And that's, I think that, you think it's helped you with the improv?
Yeah.
Has helped you do that. And I visited her once at Cedar Point. She's very good at it, yeah.
What is your dream for the Improvaneers?
So the dream is to create the program and then for it to be adopted, not just for people with Down syndrome, but all special needs. And so that we can go from these four F's that they say, which is flowers, filth, factory, and food, for people with special needs, those types of jobs, to we can grow bigger jobs and we can be leaders and creators and innovators and builders and team members and all of these amazing jobs that people with special needs can have. And you need to take my improvisation class when it comes to the Pittsburgh area.
Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Marissa.
Marissa Niwa spoke with comedian and improv teacher Rob Snow and Danny Chase at the National Down Syndrome Congress in Pittsburgh over the weekend. This piece was produced by Unabridged Press with help from the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. From Memorial Day to Labor Day, American flags are a common sight in Pittsburgh, but sometimes old glory does wear out. What should you do when your favorite emblem of American patriotism is a little too tattered for public display? Retire Your Unserviceable Old Glory is a project based in Cranberry that collects torn and faded flags for dignified destruction. Denise Etter spearheads that organization. Denise, welcome to The Confluence.
Hi, Megan. We're very happy to be here today. Thank you.
Denise, we've all seen flags waving above car lots and at ballparks that aren't in the best shape anymore. What does it mean for a flag to be unserviceable?
A flag is unserviceable when it is torn, tattered, faded, and really no longer a fitting emblem, as they say in the flag code, for display. A flag can also be unserviceable when someone wants to just get it retired. It doesn't have to be faded or torn, but they're just looking for a way to properly dispose of the flag ceremoniously and respectfully.
So what does that process look like? How do you get it down from wherever it may be positioned, and where does it go after that?
The flags come from personal homes. They come from businesses, yes. And we do get some special flags in the bins with notes on them directed to the project, military burial flags usually. And they'll put a really special note in with them and have it tied or, you know, wrapped up with the flag, telling me who the person was, what military branch they served, and what years they served. Sometimes I'll get a name of the person, but not too often. Usually it's just some details about the service of the flag. So that's very nice. But yeah, so they're personal flags, they're business flags, and there's some military flags that we get. And we do get some municipal flags, actually. You can always tell when a township or a borough is trading out their flags that have been on their telephone poles, because we will get a boatload of flags and I'll get the call, Denise, someone just dropped off 200 flags or 100 flags. So you can tell when the municipalities start to retire their flags as well.
Absolutely. What's it like to be the conduit for that? For whether it's a municipality deciding to honor their veterans by putting up all new flags, or the receptacle for a loved one who's now gone, but they still wanted to honor them in that way.
It's proud. You know, I'm very proud of the project, and I'm proud of all of the groups that participate. All flags that we get are retired. And I don't want you to think retiring flags isn't a new idea. The flag code has always described what to do with your flag when it's time to retire it. But retire your old glory is a new project in the community, a unique project that puts the convenient location bins for people to drop them off.
So then how do you retire a flag?
It's quite involved. The United States Flag Code gives detail and recommends that flags are retired, preferably by burning. And that ceremony is done by many different organizations, the Boy Scouts of America, the Girl Scouts, the American Legion, the VFW, Isaac Walton League. There's a number of organizations that do the ceremony, and it's a respectful ceremony, and it follows certain protocols, and there's certain ways that you do it by you take your whole flag that is no longer useful and needs to be retired, and you cut away the stars and the stripes from each other. You keep the stars together as the blue panel, as all one panel, and then the stripes you can cut away from the blue panel.
Stitch by stitch.
You can do it stripe by stripe, or you can just cut the star panel away from the stripe panel and retire two mm-hmm. different sections.
That sounds incredibly time intensive.
It is. It is for the groups that do the retirement ceremonies. They do a fantastic job, and they're quite dedicated to the ceremony as they're doing it.
Speaking of ceremony, what goes into that? Is it an element of song? Is there a salute involved at all for those who have served?
There can be a salute involved, and there can be song. There is no really specific written ceremony for flag retirement. The flag code doesn't write the ceremony. The flag code just writes the protocol of how you're supposed to retire flags and when you're supposed to retire flags. You can find very good ceremonies for retiring flags at the Boy Scouts website, the Girl Scouts website, the VFW, the American Legion. Any of those organizations can help you with a good, solid, respectful flag retirement ceremony.
And so I assume you've seen your fair share of those.
I have. I have seen my fair share. I enjoy everyone that I go to, and everyone is a little bit different. Each one is enjoyable, and each one is special.
What does it feel like in that moment to watch something be laid to rest, so to speak?
You know, it's a bit overwhelming at times because they're the boys that are doing them, or the men that are doing them, or the girls that are doing them. It's emotional for them, and it's something that is very near and dear to their heart, just as it should be for all of us. But when they are doing the ceremonies, they are really focused on what it means and what they are doing. They're not just destroying the flag, they're retiring the flag. And that flag, and all flags that are no longer serviceable, need to be retired in that manner, with that dignity and that respect and with that emotion from the people that are doing the ceremonies.
So how is your group, Retire Your Old Glory, trying to help?
Retire Your Old Glory is a nonprofit that I founded back in 2011. The first location was in Cranberry Township. And the project has since expanded over the years to include 15 locations now. We have locations in Erie County all the way down to Fredericksburg, Virginia. And we have found, and my husband and I would be out driving around before the project started, and we would see flags that needed to be retired. And we would stop, and my husband would run in and just have a quick conversation with the store manager, the business manager, and say, we appreciate you flying the flag, but it's a little tattered and it looks like it needs to be retired. And the question that he would get, or we would get, would be, I just don't know. What should I do with it after I take it down? I don't know where to take it. I don't know what to do with it. Sometimes we'd actually take the flags with us. And once we got to thinking about that and I investigated a little bit further, I proposed the idea to Cranberry Township to do a test run with a collection bin, and they took off with the project. And since then, like I said, the project has expanded to 15 locations and has collected and retired nearly 28,000 flags.
And this collection bin is not just your average piece of large Tupperware. It's a big bin. It looks very patriotic. What is the purpose behind that? And why was it so important to you to make it very clear what the mission of this box is?
Sure. And we do include the mission of the project on the front. We include the actual flag code so people can see what the flag code says. It stands about almost 3 feet tall with really beautifully designed patriotic graphics on the outside, specifically saying for flags only. And the locations, they're all convenient public locations. We have chosen to work with municipal buildings, libraries, recreational centers, those types of facilities that people have very easy access to on a daily basis and are comfortable stopping in and dropping off their flags to be retired.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA, and just ahead of Independence Day, we're chatting with Denise Etter. Her organization, Retire Your Old Glory, has helped respectfully dispose of nearly 28,000 American flags since she started collecting them in 2011. Denise, you started with one drop box in Cranberry. Now you've got 15 locations and host special event collections with groups all around the region. When this began, did you see 28,000 flags in your future?
Kind of, I did. You know, I'll be quite honest with you. I kind of did, because flags, you know, like today, it's a great day to be a flag. I always say when the sky is blue and the wind is blowing, it's a great day to be a flag in Pennsylvania. But in Pennsylvania, and really anywhere, when it's raining and it's cold and it's windy, it's not such a good day to be a flag. And our flags take a lot of abuse, and that's where they get the tattered and the torn look. And we're always going to have that weather here in this part of the state. And so I kind of did expect the project to keep going. It is amazing, though, that every month, you know, I get reports back in from every location. And I do focus and I do communicate with each location on a monthly basis to get flag counts. And that's where how we're able to keep the flag tally at the website. And even out of the blue, I'll get a quick reply from someone saying thank you. Someone will hug me in the parking lot when I meet them to hand off something or another, a bag of flags or something that they're going to retire. I think it's those kind of personal connections that I and the project have made that keep it going for me. But it is kind of amazing and humbling that the flag bins continue to fill up on a monthly basis for all of these years.
So where can people find a collection bin then, or find more about the organization overall?
Like I said, there's 15 locations from Erie down to Fredericksburg, and the easiest way I think that they could find a location convenient to where they are is to go to the website, which is www.retireyouroldglory.com, and there's a tab on the website that says locations with addresses and links and everything that they need to do to find their location. There's also some project information and some information about our sponsors, as well as a continuous count.
And does that help keep you going, knowing this is a service people want, that they're counting on you?
Mm-hmm. We're doing a good thing for the community and for the flag.
Denise Etter is the project coordinator for the Retire Your Unserviceable Old Glory project. She's helped collect and respectfully retire nearly 28,000 flags since 2011. Denise, thanks so much and happy Independence Day.
Thank you. Have a great holiday. Happy 4th of July, everyone.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. There have been a few shakeups at the top of the Republican Party in Allegheny County and in Pennsylvania. Dee Raja is out as head of the county GOP committee. Val DiGiorgio resigned as state party chair hours after the Philadelphia Inquirer published a story detailing sexually explicit messages between DiGiorgio and a city council candidate. What might all this mean for the GOP? And what else should we know headed into the holiday? Well, let's turn to Chris Potter, the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability team. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
So, Chris, party chair Bernadette Comfort has stepped up to acting chair. She was the vice chair. Who is she? What's her background?
Yeah, I mean, I go away for a week and the entire state GOP blows up. It's you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. Yeah, Bernie Comfort is a longtime Republican fixture in the party. She's from the eastern part of the state, spent some time here in Pittsburgh. She worked with Chatham University for a while. She has been very active in trying to get women involved in politics, Chatham being a women's school. She was involved in an effort with Christine Toretti, who's from Western Pennsylvania, Republican National Committee woman, to get women involved in politics. And as you say, she was elected alongside Mr. DiGiorgio in 2017, and she is now serving until at least July 13th, when the party will choose a new leader. She is running for that position, and her biggest rival at this point appears to be a guy named Lawrence Tabas, who was formerly a solicitor for the party. This is expected to be a really a fairly close race and a fairly brutal one.
All right. By the way, stick to the politics. Forget the Jack Nicholson impressions. Okay. So, Chris, you were on vacation last week. But I want to ask you regarding this change. Might the average person, even the average Republican voter, notice much of a change in strategy?
I don't think there aren't strong philosophical differences that have been outlined between these two candidates. It's more about sort of how the party sees itself. You know, this is a chance to sort of relitigate the 2017 election, which was between Mr. Tabas and Mr. DiGiorgio. That was a very close, very fraught, hard fought race there. And there's always going to be a question here. The party has not done well since 2016. They obviously did very poorly last year. So the question is, how do we sort of recover from that? You know, Ms. Comfort is sort of selling herself as she's a single mom. She's going to appeal to sort of those suburban female voters if she's elected, that the party struggled with last year. And if she does win, you'd have a situation where both the Democratic and the Republican parties in the state of Pennsylvania would be led by women.
How long of a term are we talking about?
So this would be to finish out the term. These are four-year terms. So this would be to finish out the term through early 2021. And then they would go and vote for new leadership at that point.
Here in Allegheny County, Saturday was the last day for Dee Raja as chair of the county Republican Party, but his successor was not elected. What happened?
Yeah, so there's a bit of controversy about this. Essentially, there were three guys running for this seat, and the way it was set up is you could either vote by absentee or you could come in any time during the course of the day Saturday, and nobody got an outright majority of the votes there. There were three guys running. Nobody got an outright majority. So then I have to kind of do this again, and it's up to the acting chair of the local party to set a new election date for that. There's been some controversy because it didn't explicitly, nowhere in the rules does it explicitly say you need an outright majority. But they just couldn't come together with one, and so that's what they got to do.
So changes at the top of the party statewide and the county, does it make a difference right away, or what about gearing up for 2020?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the concern, and one of the interesting things at the state level in particular is that not Donald Trump himself, but his son and several of his close advisors have weighed in on behalf of Ms. Comfort, and I think it suggests the party really sees this as important to what happens in 2020.
Elsewhere in the county, but on the other side of the aisle, Pittsburgh City firefighter Thomas DeAndrea is facing misdemeanor charges for a racially charged altercation with a 13-year-old black child at a playground. DeAndrea was also a Democratic committee person.
Yeah.
What happens now?
So what happens now, immediately Mr. DeAndrea faces misdemeanor charges of simple assault and criminal mischief. He has a preliminary hearing later this month. The city, as this there was video of this altercation, so it becomes viral. The city has put him, he's a firefighter, on administrative leave. There's been some talk about trying to take him from the Democratic committee, but I talked to the Democratic chair last night. She said, look, I don't really have the bylaws don't permit me to just remove somebody for anything other than purely sort of political reasons. And I can understand why people would be upset about that. But there's also the reason the rules are like that is because committee people don't want to be yanked at the whim of their chair.
All right. So maybe some retribution for at his professional job level, but not necessarily at the committee level.
Not necessarily at that level.
Finally, quickly, Auditor General Eugene DePasquale announced his candidacy for Congress this week. Some thought that he would be maybe running for governor in 2022, but Congress next year, surprising to you or not?
No, he's term limited, and this is his second term as Auditor General. And in 2020, what else is he going to run for? The other two state row offices are held by fellow Democrats. He's not going to go up against them, and there's not another statewide seat there. So this makes sense.
So this is U.S. House District 10, Dauphin County, parts of Cumberland and York counties.
Yeah.
What might that mean for him? Does the incumbent, Scott Perry, how strong of a grip does he have?
Real tight. He won by only about 3% of it against a first-term candidate last in 2018, and DePasquale is a big get for Democrats. Closely watched race.
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, Pitt's Story Jazz program has a new leader. Acclaimed improvisational flautist Nicole Mitchell says collaboration will be the key to the program's future. And as we approach another election, millions of eligible people still aren't actually registered to vote. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Avery Keatley, Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. The Confluence returns on Monday. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good holiday weekend of good news.